and launched a commission to recommend ways to reform the Supreme Court. Of all the radical ideas being floated, perhaps the most destructive of all would be to eliminate the court's power to declare a law unconstitutional. Hi, I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is First Liberty Live. Before we get started, please take a moment to like and share our videos. We are grateful that you do that. It makes you part of this effort to get our message directly to our friends and to your friends and family as well. Hey, Jeremy Dice is First Liberty's Special Counsel for Litigation and Communications. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about something that every first-year law student knows, but the rest of us do not, because it's not something we think about. Most Americans, I think, understand the idea, the concept, that the Supreme Court has the power to declare a law constitutional or unconstitutional. But it's so basic to understanding, most of us have never thought about where it came from or whether that's built into the Constitution or what. Take us back and help us understand where that very fundamental concept came from.
Well, it is partly rooted in the Constitution. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have the concept, because the Supreme Court is one of three co-equal branches of government. And we know that this is the case, right? Because the founders wanted us to have three separate but equal branches that would be able to check one another. That's called the separation of powers. And so that the executive couldn't become a king, the Congress couldn't become a super legislature, the courts were necessary to be able to maintain that function within our Republican, within our democratic form of government.
Yeah.
And so the concept developed from there under a case called Marbury versus Madison. It was about the time when Jefferson was the president and Chief Justice John Marshall was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
They were having a fuss over politics.
And it's actually even a family affair, because it was a cousin of the president that was being appointed. It was just a remarkable situation, and Chief Justice Marshall was good friends with President Jefferson. They both came from Virginia. There's a whole bunch of great backstory. You can read all about it on all the history books, of course. But the primary issue at stake here is whether or not the executive had the right to basically overrule and just kind of rule without that check and balance of things. And especially when it came to the judiciary. And so the Chief Justice John Marshall in Marbury versus Madison says it is the chief job of the Supreme Court, I'm paraphrasing, to say what the law actually is. That's the role of the constitutional order here with the judiciary itself, that once Congress passes a bill, the president signs it into law and begins its execution. If that law is in violation of the terms of the Constitution or the spirit of the Constitution itself, the Supreme Court has the final say to say, okay, this one doesn't agree with our Constitution, and therefore we can't exercise it. And that's been the law of our country now for, 200 plus years, that the Supreme Court actually has the ability to check and to balance the other branches of government to say, nope, we have a written document. We are a nation of laws, not of men, as another court would later say.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to abide by that Constitution, because if we operate outside of that, then there really is no way for us to be able to have an ordered society, because we can make up any rule that we want to and have it to be the new, latest, greatest fashion of the Supreme Court here as they have it.
And the basic idea is the Constitution itself is a set of laws that is above any law that Congress should pass. Therefore, someone has to decide if a law is in or out according to that greater law, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, we'll take that job.
Yeah, it's not unlike the contract that you might enter into for your employment or something like that. You want to have the terms and conditions set within that contract before you begin working, so that they know how you could live up to it and be rewarded, or live against it and be fired. The same thing is true with the Constitution, just on a sociological scale, right? To say, hey, we're going to order society according to these values. We're going to, and our Constitution is a doctrine of limited rights, to say, hey, we possess all the rights as citizens. That's why it starts out with those famous words, we the people, and goes on to articulate exactly how we're going to have this government rule by proxy on our behalf. We're still the kings and queens of this country as the citizens, but we're going to give limited powers and authorities to our government to be able to do a few things, like, for instance, raise a nation. Navy. Awful hard to do in our backyard pool. We've got to be able to have a common defense. And so we have Congress to be able to set up a Navy that the executive office then commands. But then it stops at the end of the articles, Article 7, and it gets into this, the very first words of the Bill of Rights are what? Congress shall make no law. In other words, we didn't give up these rights. We possess these. And what's the very first one that we possess? The first freedom is the religious freedom that we possess under the First Amendment, the free exercise of religion. And that's very important that those are written down, because if they weren't written down, somebody else could make up that they're not actually there.
Congress could drive a bulldozer right over top of them. And that's why we're talking about this, because the fundamental rights, the foundational rights of our nation are in the Constitution. Here we've got, just last month, the Harvard Law professor who's working with this commission called judicial review, which is the idea we're talking about, and I'm quoting here, an anti-democratic super weapon. He's apparently not a fan.
It was shocking to watch that, as a matter of fact, although it wasn't terribly a surprise, because in the very first meeting, this was the second meeting of this presidential commission of the Supreme Court of the United States, the very first meeting, which was scheduled for an hour and a half and lasted 21 minutes, yeah, and had people reading basically from a teleprompter, this is a show, and we know it's a show. It's a foregone conclusion as to what this commission actually wants to do, but politically, rhetorically, we've got all the window dressing of President Forrest to give the appearance of legitimacy here with a bunch of ivory tower eggheads that are listening about or debating about these topics and things. So I digress, but back to the point. On the second meeting, they're now talking about different ways of court reform. And now it's interesting because the commission was billed as a court packing commission to study the idea of court packing. And within about a minute and a half of actually going into the court, the meetings, they switched quickly from court packing to court reform, which is a much broader category. Amongst those things that they wanted to consider is whether or not judicial review is still a viable thing. Well, this professor clearly does not think that it is, nor should it be, that it actually should be jettisoned as something of an ancient past, and a bad one at that, and put in place as something else entirely. What he said, what it is, he didn't really get to say.
Right.
But we do know that one of the ideas that has been batted about is that judicial review should be removed, or at least that it should be curtailed. For instance, one proposal on the table right now is to say that if Congress passes a law, so an act of Congress, it could only be invalidated by the Supreme Court by a supermajority of justices. Now, that could be right now just seven justices with a nine-member court, or if we have one that gets to be about the size of the Galactic Senate from Star Wars, maybe it's something much bigger than that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But either way, it undermines the entire concept of separation of powers. It basically says what Congress says is the king of the castle, it is the law of the land, and it cannot be questioned. That goes completely against what our founding fathers wanted, and it is a direct threat not only to our general freedom, but specifically to our religious freedom, because we know the laws, many of the laws that are under target right now are things like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that the Congress despises, but they can't get a court to invalidate.
And in many ways, I mean, we hear the president talk about it as court reform, but when you look at it, when it's changing these foundational stones of America as we know it, it's really nation reform that they're looking at. They're wanting to fundamentally change, alter the way that our government functions.
Without the consent of the governed, by the way. And that's what has me the most upset about this entire commission, is that they have 36 members of this presidential commission that are from different universities, colleges of law, law schools. They've got some former federal judges. All of them have a direct bias towards the left. There are maybe one, two, or three members that are kind of to the right, or yeah, at least to the center. And so we know where this is going, but there is very limited input. For example, there are two meetings that are having. One was last June, and the next one is actually next week, July 20th, when they're going to be meeting again. And the commission is glad to be hearing testimony from everybody, as long as it's the 24 people that they've chosen to testify before. Not even Kelly Shackelford could get on the list. And goodness sakes, we tried to get him on that dais, but they wouldn't even want to have a guy like him, who's an expert in religious freedom, come out
and testify.
And the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah.
And so this is all taking place outside of the direct control and, frankly, the permission, I think, of the people of the United States. And I think that is very, very frightening.
You mentioned one of the ideas that's being floated around apart from that. Let's go through, just to give people an idea how much they want to consider at least changing the foundations of our nation as we know it. I want you to explain each one and the impact it would have. We'll go through these one at a time just to give you an idea what we're talking about. The first one, which we've talked the most about, is court packing. What is it and what would it do?
It would, court packing is very simple. It would be adding members to the court or taking members away, but nobody takes members away, so they're going to add more there. I think there's a bill right now that would suggest adding four more members right now, going from 9 to 13 members of the Supreme Court. But this would be a matter of political football. Every time the Congress changes the majority or the White House changes, they could add another justice. And here we are off to the races of that Galactic Senate again, of having this huge panel of judges and justices, rather. And then how they would choose those panels would be actually more remarkable still, because now you have 13, 18, 25 different justices on there. They're not all going to sit in one argument, because theoretically we're going to have more cases going to the Supreme Court under this idea as
so
well.
So then the idea of smaller panels to take the cases.
Smaller panels, which comes to my favorite thing, which I guess they would select smaller panels by lottery system, they say. How do you pick the lottery system? I can only envision the fact that they have that ball machine, you know, the ping pong ball machine you see in the lottery. They're going to pick out justices by the balls, the ping pong balls with their names on it, and put them on panels. It's a silly way of going about a judicial system.
And there's no guarantee that any particular panel would be balanced, which is what they keep saying the goal is. It could be stacked one way or the other, and we could see enormous swings in what the law is.
In fact, we know that from historic experience here. Thankfully, we're not down the road to where Venezuela is right now, but I mean, without any active participation on our part, we could very quickly slide in that direction. Hugo Chavez removed or actually packed his court, and very soon thereafter, there were, I think, 45,000 different opinions issued by this. I think it was first to 15, I think it went up to 23 or something like that. And this huge Supreme Court now down to zero went against his regime.
Which
zero.
Tells you something.
Something
about
may
the
have gone wrong there.
Another idea that's being floated around is the idea of term limits for justices. What's the problem with that?
Well, look, there's support on both sides of that issue, right? Because in some sense, it seems the most fair way of going about things. Oh, okay, we'll put term limits in here, and so you're going to serve for a period of 18 years or something like that, which may be about the traditional professional life expectancy of a federal judge or what have you. The problem, again, is this becomes another political football that you have. The founding fathers wanted judicial independence, and all of these proposals go against judicial independence. It allows the political system to infiltrate its way into the judicial independent body of the Supreme Court and finagle with it and cause political inroads there on an area where we want judicial independence because that creates fairness in the process. We don't want to have our constitutional future decided by popular vote. We want them to say, no, the Constitution has words that have meaning, that means something to protect us today. That's why we don't want this kind of thing going on. The same thing would go on with term limits, in my estimation. Yeah. I have friends that would actually disagree with me on that point and say that it might be a viable option. I do wonder, though, how that would be functional in its practical sense. Is that just a minor act of Congress, or do we actually have to amend the Constitution? I think we actually would have to amend the Constitution, and we know, and we may get into this later, that that would be a non-starter for most Americans.
Yeah, and my understanding is the founders wanted life terms for Supreme Court justices to insulate them from everything political and the heat and coolness of the population as they move forward.
That's
to protect
exactly
them
right.
from the political winds of the day.
That's exactly right. And the influence of, going back to the common law, to the influence of the king. I mean, those that sat by patronage of the king were a little bit more beholden to the guy who gave them their patronage. And so to create that sort of patronage within the modern sense of term limits, you'll feel more beholden to the political party who puts you in there, which creates all kinds of problems. We don't want that level of unfairness, the lack of independence that would follow from that. We want an independent judiciary.
Now, there are more ideas they floated around, but we've covered most of the ones that are getting most of the conversation. And that should give people an idea of what we're talking about. When you look at the big picture across all of those, what do you see?
Well, I see a debate occurring right now on how to go about court reform. It's not whether to go about court reform. And I think that is the most concerning part to me right now. The status quo is the very best. And as the public comments that I've read through, which everybody can submit a public comment or just join with ours if we want, the public comments are saying, look, there's no problem here. We should keep this as it is. The judiciary that we have is the envy of the free world. Why would we mess with it all? Mm-hmm. And yet there are those, especially on the left and certainly on the far left, but it's creeping straight into the middle of the left right now, that see this as a problem. They believe that the justices that were appointed by President Trump because one died, one retired, and another one died, they call that court packing. No, he's just simply fulfilling the role that he is constitutionally obligated to do, to nominate and then confirm by the Senate these
just as
new
presidents
justices.
Have done for 150 years.
Precisely. And so I'm concerned that we're going to have something come recommended out of this committee, out of this commission. They say that they're simply to provide analysis. We know how analysis goes.
But even President Biden, when he was setting it up, he changed his language from whether to reform the court to they're going to tell me how to reform the court. And that change in language was significant to me, at least.
It is very significant, and I think every American should be very concerned about this, because the more that this commission and then later on the politicians begin to tinker with this court and come up with these ideas, the more steam it's going to build itself to go forward. And we're going to see something change within our Supreme Court and reduce the independence of our judiciary. And we just simply cannot allow that kind of thing to happen. We need to stand firm right now to prevent this thing from going any further.
And the one issue, and we've been hitting this heavy here at First Liberty, we've got the largest campaign we've ever done, national scale, trying to get people engaged in this and get them to speak out. But the biggest threat really is adding extra seats to the court, not replacing the ones who are there, but adding one, two, three. They say four, but if you're going to add four, why not seven? I mean, there's no limit to what they would do once they start down that road. That argument, though, is based on this idea that the court is currently out of balance. But you took a look at the decisions in the most recent term with those three judges, justices that President Trump put on the court. It's just not true.
Oh, it's absolutely not true. And it's remarkable. If you go back in your time machine real quick to right before the election of 2020, in October, when Amy Coney Barrett was going through her confirmation process, you will recall the left. In fact, Sheldon Whitehouse had, you know, the whole thing, pictures and strings. I mean, the whole conspiracy chart was thrown out there. We had these big cutouts of people who were going to lose their health insurance because Amy Coney Barrett was going to be the person who's going to decide that fifth vote to overturn the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
It didn't happen. She was in the majority to affirm its continuation. But more importantly, I think it was 46% of the time, maybe 43% of the time, the court voted in unanimity. That means all nine justices, 9-0, voted together to on a particular issue, including most recently the Fulton case, which was a very controversial case involving both religious freedom and touching upon LGBTQ plus whatever rights that are out there. Yeah. On things which normally you would expect to be a divided court. It was a 9-0 opinion. It was remarkable. And if you add in there 8-1 opinions and 7-2 opinions and even 6-3, which is still a sizable majority of the court, the number goes astronomically higher. I think it was only like 16 cases that they were divided 5-4. So this boogeyman that's out there, that this is a divided court, a sharply divided court, as the left loves to say, is just simply false and wrong, and you should not ever trust that ever again.
And the advice that I like the most is from perhaps the most left of the justices on the court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who recently died. Even she said, I think 9 is a good number.
It is a good number, and she knows that it's a good number because it's been working well. That 9-0, that kind of 43-46% of the time, a unanimity, mm-hmm. that trends at the same pace over the course of a decade. And so this isn't just a recent development that they're somehow scared about having court packing, they've got to moderate themselves. No, it's not the case. This court is not broken. It is absolutely functioning exactly how the Founding Fathers wanted it to
function. When it's frustrating and infuriating.
To the left, and absolutely, that's right.
Yeah. All right, Jeremy, anything else you'd like to add before I let you go?
No, look, I think it's important for us to be a participant in this process. And so we're putting together at First Liberty a public comment that we would like people to join on with us as well.
Yeah.
You can certainly submit your own public comment. I would encourage people to do that. You can find that information at whitehouse.gov, I think. But go to supremecoup.com because I think we have all the information there for you anyway.
Yep.
And we will eventually have that public comment for people to read. The commission needs to hear from the people of the United States. They cannot be doing this in silence and in darkness. What does the Washington Post say? Democracy or New York Times?
New York Times.
Democracy dies in darkness, right?
Yeah.
that's exactly what's occurring here right now with this commission. Be the steward. Steward the government that's been entrusted to your care very well, and let them know that we, the people, don't consent to changing what the Founding Fathers, the wisdom they put in place to create an independent judiciary 200 plus years ago. That's the thing that we ought to hold on to and not change.
Very good. Well, don't miss your chance to do something about this. In April, as we talked about, the president established this executive order establishing a judicial commission to start examining, as he put it, how to reform the court. He euphemistically calls it court reform, but now you have a better idea of it. They will deliver their final report in November. He also asked the commission to seek and to consider public input, and that's where you come in, and this is why your voice is urgently needed right now. First Liberty is leading a large-scale national campaign and effort to make sure your voice is heard on this important issue. We urge you to stand with us and reject this radical plan to pack the court. Go to supremecoup.com. You can get the facts, truth, and history behind this brazen overthrow of the court. And while you're there, you can add your name to our coalition. Just look for Join in the menu at the top. Your voice is so critical to this process. So go to supremecoup.com and also share that link with your friends and family. The more voices, the better, so that they can hear from Americans saying, we have a better idea about this. And by the way, this is our country. That's the way the founders set it up to begin with. We will have regular updates here on First Liberty Live so you can have a trustworthy analysis of what's happening. Jeremy, thanks again for your input today. Very helpful. And we will see you next Thursday right here on First.